Haters and gentle friends, welcome to That Final Girl Life. It's your new favourite final girl here, taking you through the horrors and out the other side to find out what life is really like after the movie ends. I can't believe I need to say this, but apparently it's a whole thing now. I am an actual real-life human being, not an AI. I physically write all my scripts. I watch the movies at least twice before I do an episode on them. Any resources I use, like other people's articles or studies which I've found helpful, will be in the show notes. In this episode, we'll be discussing the deeply claustrophobic movie The Descent and its rage-fueled final girl, Sarah. Please be aware that there will be spoilers throughout the episode. There will also be spoilers for The Descent Part 2, which I won't be focusing on in any great depth, but it will come into the equation towards the end. In this episode, I'll be talking about grief, child loss, suicide, men having affairs, betrayal in friendship, being stuck in small spaces, and of course, PTSD. Ready? Strap on your climbing gear and make sure your arrogant friend hasn't left the map in the car as we make our way down into The Descent. We begin with a group of friends whitewater rafting. They're visibly having a fantastic time, and it sets us up with the concept of a group of adventurous women who are getting the absolute most out of life. Sarah's husband and daughter are waiting for them on the bank. The drive back from the river is frosty between the couple, but Sarah doesn't know why. Just as they're about to get into it, there's a graphic car crash and Sarah wakes up in the hospital, screaming for her daughter, who, we quickly learn, is dead, along with her husband. Cut to a year later. The group of friends meet up in the Appalachian Mountains for a cave-based adventure. We learn that it's the first time Sarah's met up with them all since the accident, and they're planning to take it easy in some level 2 caves, which apparently means ones that have already been thoroughly checked out, and therefore should be pretty straightforward for a group of experienced climbers. Except that there's a bunch of really unsubtle foreshadowing that hints at their trip being ill-fated. Crows, a dead deer, bloody grooves inside the cave in the shape of fingerprints, a whole flock of bats suddenly taking to the sky. It's almost as if something's trying to tell them this is a bad idea. But I've never met a woman who wasn't skilled at ignoring a red flag, so down they go. They crawl through the first tunnel between caves. This film is not for the claustrophobic. Sarah is the last to come through, and she has one of the equipment bags with her. However, she panics halfway down the tunnel, and one of the others has to go in and extract her. Assuming it's just anxiety, she talks to Sarah and reassures her. You can breathe. And then the stone shifts, and they both realise the tunnel is about to cave in. A mad scramble manages to get them both out to the other side, but the rope bag is lost. This is a concerning situation, even for people who are regular cavers. Juno, the adventurous one whose idea this was, is asked to bring out the map so that they can get their bearings. But Juno has left the map in the car. Deliberately, it turns out. I put in a flight plan for Boreham Caverns, says Rebecca, and this isn't Boreham Caverns, is it? In other words, they're stuck down here and no one is coming to look for them. Not only that, but they're in a completely undiscovered cave system full of unknown dangers purely because of Juno's hubris. Everyone is very angry. But they have to set that aside and try to find a way out. They look for an exit, crawl through some more tunnels, come up to a huge gaping pit. It's deep. Very deep. Most of them manage to get across. Juno goes last, insisting on collecting the equipment on the way. We'll need everything we've got, she says, referencing the missing bag. Which is true, but also another example of Juno wanting to be the main character once again. On the other side of the pit, they find signs that they are not the first to ever have been down here. There's equipment there which is around 100 years old. And, both more and less surprisingly, cave art. They realise it shows that there are two entrances to the cave system, which means they do have a shot at finding a way out. Encouraged, they carry on. Holly, a young, boisterous friend of Juno's, races ahead, not fully checking where she's going, and promptly falls down a deep hole. Her leg is fucked. I'm sure that's not the medical term, but it's true. There's like a bit of bone sticking out and shit. It's gnarly. Luckily, one of them is a med student, so she sets the leg in a splint while Sarah looks around to try to work out which way they should go next. As Sarah peers into the darkness, she sees something strange, a human figure, a man, she thinks, running away down the corridor. She tells the others, who are sceptical. Juno just straight up doesn't believe her. Things are tense in the group. People are hurt, people are angry, all of them are desperate to get out. They press on and stumble across what I described in the notes I was making as a boneyard. I don't know if that's an actual word, but I mean like a pit full of bones, like where Scar and the hyenas hang out in The Lion King. It is here that they discover Sarah was neither exaggerating nor hallucinating. There are, in fact, kind of semi-human people things down here, but they're creatures more than people, really. Pale, wet, and screechy, with an appetite for human flesh. Not the best news. Holly, the injured member of the group, promptly gets eaten. This incites a huge bloody fight scene in which I couldn't keep track of everything that was happening, but it looked like it would have been a lot of fun to film. Juno, in a moment of panic, whips around and stabs the creature behind her, only to discover that she's stabbed her friend Beth in the neck. Beth falls to the ground, and Juno leaves her there. To die. Alone. With the terrifying creatures. We're definitely not meant to like Juno. We cut to Sarah, who's passed out but is now waking up. She realises that the creatures can't see and that they hunt using sound, a realisation two of the other women are simultaneously coming to in a different part of the cave. Nonetheless, they still get attacked by the creatures, until Juno saves them. She tells them Holly and Beth are dead. The others share their newfound knowledge about how the creatures use sound to locate their prey. They start to move off in search of an exit, but Juno says she's not leaving without Sarah. Meanwhile, Sarah has been experiencing a revelation of her own. She has come across Beth, who is still bleeding out where Juno left her. Beth tells Sarah what has happened and begs Sarah to kill her. Reluctantly, Sarah does. Sarah then has an epic fight scene all of her own, which includes the iconic shot of her lying in what looks like a literal pond of blood, but might just be water under the red lights of the torches they're carrying. It's a very cool fight scene. My notes app contains phrases like blood spurty eye and fucking badass. We cut back to the other three, who find themselves surrounded by creatures. They try to run, but two of them get eaten. Only Juno survives, and even then just barely. She ends up fighting a creature underwater, dragging herself out, pulling herself up a wet, slippery cave wall, and Sarah grabs her and pulls her to safety. Sarah is visibly furious with Juno. She asks if Beth is dead and if Juno saw her die. Juno nods. They move on together. Another big, gory fight scene awaits them when more creatures attack. During a brief lull in which the creatures have retreated, Sarah reveals that she knows what Juno did to Beth. Hearing the creatures beginning to creep closer again, Sarah wounds Juno, who screams. Sarah then turns and leaves Juno to be killed, just like she left Beth. As Sarah runs, Juno screams. It's left ambiguous whether this is purely uncontrolled horrific screaming or whether she's deliberately screaming to keep them off Sarah's trail. I'll leave you to decide what you want to believe about Juno here. Sarah scrambles up a steep wall littered with bones. She reaches the top, pushes through some overgrowth, and bursts forth into the sunlight. She races through the woods, finds a car, and drives away. When a huge truck full of logs passes her, Final Destination style, she stops and pulls over, trying to pull herself together. When she glances to her right, she sees the ghost of Juno appear beside her, and she screams. Somehow, in the 20 years since I last watched it, I had entirely forgotten the grief part of the storyline. The film begins with Sarah losing her husband and child in a horrible accident, and then the context of the caving expedition is that it's the first time she's met up with all her friends since that happened. Which means the whole film can easily be read as a metaphor for grief. I'm going to start by talking about the movie as being potentially that, and then later on in the episode I'll discuss Sarah's post-descent life if the events in the caves actually happened. A lot of this will overlap anyway, the grief is there regardless of whether or not it's the whole story. When Sarah gets stuck in the tunnel and her friend is trying to encourage her not to panic and to move forward, she says, "The worst thing that could possibly happen to you has already happened. This is just a poxy cave." A sudden, unexpected loss incurs a different kind of grief from a loss you've been expecting. If you were present for the actual death and it happened in a traumatic way, as is the case with Sarah, the level of trauma would be horrific. Watching a pole spear your husband and daughter right through their heads is not something most people are psychologically prepared for. Yet the husband is largely absent from what we see of Sarah's grief in the film. I think the only time he comes up, please correct me if I'm wrong, is when we learn that Juno was having an affair with him, something that was hinted at in the opening sequence by the river and is confirmed in the caves. But even then, it's not spoken about directly. Sarah's not the only one who lost something in that accident, is what Juno says to Beth at one point. Losing someone you're in a relationship with, when that relationship has some pretty big issues, will often bring up some really complicated feelings. At the beginning of the movie, we're led to believe that Sarah doesn't know anything about the affair, that her husband is being distant and weird, but she doesn't know why. Still, I don't think the drive home from the river will be the first time her husband has been acting strangely. Probably he's been cagey and secretive, doing all the classic things, coming home at odd hours, working late, not wanting to be intimate with Sarah as much as before, and so on. So Sarah had probably been feeling the distance for some time and wondering about it. This might mean that by the time he dies, a part of her has already been pre-grieving the relationship. Often we intuit something long before we properly know it, which is why by the time a confrontation and confession happens, it's sometimes past the point of no return already. Communication has broken down gradually over a period of weeks or months, trust is frayed almost to breaking point, and then it's very difficult to rebuild. So perhaps in some ways, her husband's affair might have softened the grieving process for Sarah. Beyond which, grieving the loss of a child is its own particular kind of horror. That was probably always going to overshadow the loss of her husband, even if their relationship had been fine. Part of my PhD is about child loss, baby loss to be specific. The reason I'm looking into that is because I think it has a different flavour from other kinds of loss, from a selfhood perspective. What do I mean by that? In Western philosophy, and in popular culture more generally, we tend to think of death as something that brings meaning to life. In Only Lovers Left Alive, the existential vampire horror starring Tilda Swinton and Tom Hiddleston, we can see this played out on screen. The vampires have eternal life, and therefore they're bored. Life has lost a lot of its meaning. There's surely only so much you can do before eternity becomes a drag. Unless you're the crew from What We Do in the Shadows, of course, who seem to be capable of centuries of fun. But the idea goes, life is meaningful because it is finite, death makes life finite, therefore death makes life meaningful. This is why a brush with death can cause people to reevaluate their lives. It's also an explanation for the classic midlife crisis. Suddenly you realise you're halfway through your probable lifespan already, and what do you have to show for it? Where are you now compared to where you thought you'd be, where you wanted to be? Heidegger was a German philosopher who wrote a lot about what it means to be human. He spoke about what I've just mentioned, the idea that death brings meaning to life and that realising you're going to die can prompt that kind of existential crisis where you're like, oh shit, what am I doing with my life? At that point, Heidegger says, you basically have two options. You can either face up to where you are in life and make any changes you want to make, or you can stick your fingers in your ears, ignore it, and just try to keep going while the nagging realisation that you haven't lived up to your potential gradually eats away at your insides until you die anyway. Like we all will. I'm editorialising a bit, but that's the general vibe. Heidegger spoke about what kinds of things might remind us of death in this way. Other philosophers have carried on with this theme. Experiences like becoming disabled or losing a loved one can surely make us think about our own death and how we might want to have been living before it happens. I know my experience of becoming a wheelchair user definitely prompted some existential thoughts, although, to be fair, I was already kind of prone to that anyway. For Heidegger, though, losing somebody else doesn't really count. This sheds light on one of the main criticisms of Heidegger, that his philosophy is too individualistic and doesn't account for the fact that other people are really important to us and can have a hugely significant impact on our lives. I think Heidegger would say that he's not denying that other people are important, though. Rather, he's saying that what you lose when you lose someone else is not the same as what you lose if you yourself die. If you die, you lose the whole of yourself. If you become disabled, let's say an accident paralyses you from the waist down, then you lose such a hugely significant part of yourself that your life will never look the same again. Whereas if you lose someone else, even someone very close to you, you are still you afterwards, even if you've been affected by the experience. You might validly argue, along with many modern-day philosophers, that this underestimates the value of other people to our lives. We do become different people when we lose someone important. Life isn't ever quite the same again. And that's true. I think Heidegger's trying to say something a bit more subtle here, though, and this forms part of the basis of my PhD thesis. What Heidegger is doing is not saying other people aren't important or that we aren't changed by their deaths in important ways. What he's saying is that we tend to understand what a self is by referring to a continuity of identity. In other words, whilst of course people change and develop and learn over time, not all of us changes at once. There's some kind of continuity there, even if it's difficult to specifically point to. In losing someone I love, I lose their self from my life. The relationship is important, but it's not myself that I lose. And even when I've lost them, I still remain in some kind of relationship with them, even after they're dead, by remembering them and holding their memory with me as I move through my life. At the end of last year, I lost 3 friends in quick succession. One in particular has been hard to cope with, because we spoke almost every day, and she was someone I talked to often about my thesis. I was finding the grief almost unbearable until I printed out a picture of her and put it in a little frame which hangs off the corner of the bookstand on my desk. Now I can still talk to her every day about my PhD, even though she's not there anymore. And although this doesn't make the grief go away, it does make it less difficult to live with, because it reminds me that alongside the tragic loss of Nina, I also hold the wonderful memory of who she was in my life. Okay, Shindy, I hear you say, but why are you talking about your friends dying and German philosophy when you're supposed to be talking about a cave-based horror movie? I'm getting there, I promise. When we lose a friend or a partner, we lose who they were to us. But they were always their own separate person, too. Although the bond might have been really strong, there will always have been parts of their lives we didn't have access to. Perhaps we met when we were in our 20s. Perhaps we're siblings, but we went to different universities. Regardless, most of the relationships we have are very much between 2 separate selves, us and them. But then there's the loss of a child. Here we go. A child is a person in their own right, of course. But the relationship between parent and child is different from any other relationship, I believe, in terms of selfhood. Very few parents decide to have children and just wait to see what comes out. Most, if not all, parents have ideas regarding who they want their children to be, and usually those ideas will have something to do with who they themselves are. Often, parents fill their children with projections of who they wish they'd been able to be. I've seen this so much in my work as a therapist from both sides, people deciding to have children because they feel like it's too late for them to feel fulfilled in themselves, so they have kids hoping they'll get a kind of second-hand fulfillment through them instead. Which rarely works, by the way, and often leads to the other end of things, parents pushing their kids into living in ways that really don't suit them, which causes resentment and anger and on and on. But a certain degree of identification with your child and wanting them to be like you in some way is completely normal. Few of us would want a family full of people we don't get on with or have nothing in common with. Think about it. What would you struggle with? I don't have children and I don't plan to, but if I somehow ended up with one, I'm pretty sure I would struggle if I got a really energetic, extroverted child who constantly wanted to be on the go. Perhaps you'd struggle with a really quiet child, or a messy one, or one who cried a lot. So with children specifically, we have this thing where parents place a lot of their selfhood onto or into the child, more than we tend to do with adults who already have fully formed personalities when we meet them. Of course, there are plenty of ways children can come into our lives when they already have noticeable personalities, adoption, for example, but I'm trying to keep it relatively simple so that this episode isn't like 3 hours long. What might this mean then for a parent who's lost a child from a Heideggerian perspective? That's probably not something you expected to be asked in a horror movie podcast. But it's interesting to think about. Because if Heidegger's right that the death of another person doesn't completely bring us into a relationship with our own death because of their separateness from us, and if it's also true that children aren't seen as fully separate selves by their parents, then there's something kind of extra going on when someone loses a child. I don't necessarily mean the grief is worse or more intense, although I think some people would probably argue that it is. What I mean is that I think it's got a different existential flavour, because what we're losing is something more like ourselves than anything else we could lose. So, I think Sarah would be in a pretty fucked up state, is what I'm basically saying here. Not only has she lost her child, which, as we've just lengthily discussed, is a particularly existentially challenging kind of loss, she's also lost her husband, with whom she had a complicated, probably thorny relationship right before he died. And she's lost them both at the same time, in a horrific car crash which she was also in, and she saw the whole thing. One of my friends, who's also a therapist, likes to reference the children's book We're Going on a Bear Hunt when she's talking to clients about processing trauma. You can't go over it, you can't go under it, you have to go through it. And that's true of grief too. Immediately after the deaths, Sarah shuts down and doesn't see her friends for a while. That's completely normal. I say normal, there isn't really a normal way to grieve. We all do it differently. But it's okay when you're processing something this huge to have to pull back a bit from your social life. Once she's through that initial stage, which for me often involves a lot of staring blankly at walls and not doing very much else, then if we're reading the movie as a metaphor, Sarah tackles her grief head on. She descends down into the very depths of it, feeling things she's never felt before in the process. It's interesting that Juno is the one who forces them into the unknown cave system. Sarah and the others signed up for caving, she's willing to face her grief, but Juno pulls them into something darker and much more dangerous than Sarah feels ready for. Of course, Sarah survives, she has to, she's our final girl, but just barely. And everyone else, including Juno herself, apparently dies. Which, if we're reading the film metaphorically, can be seen as Juno's tendency to just carelessly forge whatever path she wants without thinking of others. The affair, for instance. And yes, Juno is grieving too. Just because their relationship was illicit doesn't mean it didn't include real love. But Juno is riding her grief right into the danger zone, allowing it to pull her into all her worst behaviours. This is so, so easy to do, and a level of that is almost expected. Even if we've done loads of work and managed to step away from unhelpful behaviours in general, grief might well send us spiralling back into old patterns. Juno was still in those patterns at the beginning of the film, and we see her losing all sense of care and humanity as the expedition goes on. Sarah, by contrast, becomes more and more determined. Sam is right when she talks Sarah through the tunnel. The worst thing has already happened, and yet Sarah's still here. So what now? Is she just going to give up because life is too hard and passively wait to die? That doesn't sound like a final girl to me. Grief has this way of bringing up things you didn't even know were inside you, and this is one way we could interpret the monsters. Whatever space the person was filling inside you, whatever part of you they fulfilled, is now empty, and into that emptiness is where the creatures creep. Suddenly you're spending £300 on trinkets at 4 a.m. and completely forgetting about it until your porch is flooded with parcels. Or you discover that wine makes it all go away for a while, and it's so much nicer when it goes away, so... more wine? Or you find yourself watching 365 horror movies in a year because they're the only thing that touches the level of trauma you've experienced, and then you somehow end up starting a podcast about them. The monsters, potentially, could also just be people. Because the people around you become weird when you're grieving. It's not their fault, you're being weird too. Grief fucks everything up, turns it upside down and inside out, makes everything not make sense. You might lose friends. Probably not by them dying in a previously uncharted cave system, but who knows? You might find yourself out of reach even of those friends who stick around. And then there are all the other people, the weird peripheral creatures in your life whom you have to deal with every day. Your colleagues, your neighbours, that woman who always sits diagonally across from you on the morning commute, the person who prepares your order in the artsy coffee shop at the end of your street. They're suddenly so alien with their smiles and their small talk and their freshly laundered clothes. None of this matters, you want to scream at them. How can you possibly just be carrying on with life when the world has caved in? But that's the thing. Theirs hasn't. Grief is such a lonely process. Your friends can be there for you and can help you through parts of it, of course. But ultimately, you're going to have to pull yourself through on your own strength as well. Which Sarah does, and she emerges gasping into the sunlight at the end of the film. It looks like a birth scene, which makes sense. Coming out of a period of deep grief or other trauma can feel like being reborn into a world that's unfamiliar because it's so very different from the one you left behind. So how does Sarah move forward? Regardless of whether the movie is a metaphor for grief or the events actually happened, Sarah is going to have some significant grieving still left on her plate after she's gone through everything we see in the film. Now she's not only grieving her husband and child, but also her lost friends. The final shot of the movie shows Sarah sitting in her car at the side of the road, turning to look at the passenger seat and seeing an apparition of Juno. This understandably freaks her out. But it also fits in with how she's been grieving throughout the film. We see several times that her daughter comes to her in dreams and apparitions, simultaneously freaking her out, and sometimes also giving her a push to carry on. Now Sarah's going to be haunted by even more apparitions, although somehow I doubt that all the friends will be in them. We know Juno is, and I guess Beth might be too, given that Sarah herself had to kill her. She'll be raw after leaving the cave system, emotionally and also physically. We don't talk enough about the physical effects grief can have, I think. Just last month, artist and author Marjane Satrapi died of a broken heart following the death of her husband. Many people experience physical symptoms as a result of grief, some temporary, others long-lasting. Nina, the friend I mentioned earlier, had MS. She identified it as having started when she had a particularly traumatic miscarriage and learned she would never be able to have biological children. The resulting pain brought on the MS, she always said, and then ultimately it was the MS that killed her last year, when she went to Dignitas, having reached a point where she just couldn't cope with the aggressive nature of her symptoms anymore. There are plenty of less fatal examples too. People experiencing chest pains, migraines, functional neurological symptoms, all sorts of medical issues they've never had before. If we're doing a straight reading of the movie, then as well as all the compounding losses, Sarah has also just climbed through a cave system and nearly died. She's been exposed to all sorts of unknown bacteria and undoubtedly swallowed some unidentified semi-human blood. She's been crushed by rocks, her muscles have been pushed to the limit, she's trekked through dusty caverns filled with bones and water and previously human mulch. What she's breathed in during that time can't have done her any favours. So Sarah has surely got to find herself with some weird physical symptoms. At least one mystery virus or bacterial infection, I'd imagine. Definitely some aches and pains, probably a cracked rib or two. Once the adrenaline of dragging herself to safety wears off, she'll be needing some proper medical attention. And she's in a foreign country. She's British and the caves are in the US, so she'll have to deal with an unfamiliar and famously expensive medical system. In some ways, though, it might be psychologically helpful to her that her immediate medical care takes place before she flies home. It creates a separation, and hopefully arriving home will feel comforting, perhaps for the first time since her husband and daughter died. There will be a level of peace, at least in comparison to the caves and the hospital, but there will also be such a gaping emptiness. We don't know if Sarah had some kind of corporate job alongside being a parent, but if she did, it wasn't important enough to come up in the dialogue. She's also just spent a bunch of time nearly dying in unending caverns and then recuperating in hospital, so by the time she comes home, she might not have had a job to go back to. Given what we know about Sarah's tendencies prior to meeting up with her friends, we can assume she'll act similarly now that she has even more people to grieve. In my mind, she's in a gloomy house with big windows, the room lit with that particular shade of blue that tells us a scene is taking place at twilight. She's wandering aimlessly around her stylish but now soulless home, occasionally picking up a photograph but putting it down before she properly looks at it. We discussed dissociation in the first episode, when we looked at Danny from Midsummer, and I think this is what Sarah will be doing now. A whole load of staring into space and not really being inside herself. She might even have some out-of-body experiences. She'll definitely be hallucinating, since she was already doing that before. And she'll also be having whatever physical symptoms are coming to her as a result of having climbed through the caves. She will, in other words, be pretty haunted. Floating around her house like she too is a ghost, periodically invaded by the apparitions of the people she's lost, still trying to come to terms with the death of her daughter, but now also having lost all her friends, one of whom she had to kill. That's going to come back, probably in her nightmares. She'll wake up repeatedly drenched in sweat, sometimes remembering her horrible dreams, other times unable to recall what happened, but feeling such a thick and dank dread that she'd almost rather deal with the actual memories. The thing is, there's not much for her anymore. She survived. For what? Now she's just living with ghosts and cosplaying as one of them. After a significant loss, people can, of course, pick up their lives and carry on, or change something and create a life that feels very different. But the level of loss Sarah has experienced, and the fact that A, both incidents involved more than one loss, and B, both were particularly horrific in and of themselves, means that she's unlikely to be able to do that, certainly not in the immediate aftermath. Which is where I think the concept of the Descent Part 2 actually makes sense. I don't think it would be as quick as it's portrayed in the second movie. A doctor is hardly going to allow an amnesiac patient to go clambering through a dangerous cave system a mere couple of days after she barely escaped it with her life. But I think that after a year, maybe even just a few months, Sarah might well feel like her only option is to go back to the caves again and try to bring her friends home, even though what she'll be bringing back is only their remains. This works regardless of whether we read the film straight or see it as a metaphor. Once again, she's in a position where the only way out is through. So, a bit like in our first episode, this final girl doesn't get a happy ending. The Descent Part 2 doesn't give her one either. Waking up with no memory of what happened, she's taken back to the caves by her doctor to see if they can find any of her friends down there alive. Once there, she runs off into the darkness, and chaos ensues as the team are, of course, set upon by the creatures. Major spoiler warning. She doesn't get out of the second film alive. She fights a solid fight and nearly makes it, but right at the end she screams, allowing the creatures to come for her so that one of the others has a fighting chance of escaping. Second spoiler warning, she doesn't survive either. Which, unfortunately, also all makes sense, regardless of whether we're looking at a movie or a metaphor. Of course, logically, if the caves and the creatures are real, it's pretty likely they'd eat her if they caught her. But even if it's metaphorical, with a grief that huge... Is it survivable? Yeah. Is it easy to survive? Not at all. Plenty of people, faced with a level of grief that shatters the foundations of their world, won't make it through. As far as we could tell, prior to the events of the first film, Sarah's primary focus in life was parenting her child. Another important aspect was her adventures with her friends, where she got to let her hair down and feel the adrenaline rush of being in nature, recognising her place as a mere measly human on this earth. Now both of those are gone. So is her husband, so there isn't even anyone to rebuild with. She could start again completely from scratch, make new friends, find a job, move to a new place, in time maybe even find a partner and start a new family. But it's entirely understandable if what that would ask of her is just too much. She's already lost everything. What's the point of carrying on now? This has been kind of a depressing episode, I know. But that's the thing about being a final girl. Life doesn't tend to come up roses afterwards. Some of us survive and carry on, like Cecilia from last week's episode, but we're still forever changed. I'm in a wheelchair. I have lasting injuries in places you'd rather not even think about. Even before my disabilities had gotten to the stage they're at now, I was severely affected in that I was a chronic workaholic. I'd have multiple jobs at any given time, working day shifts followed by evening shifts followed by nights and weekend shifts, because it felt better than feeling the after effects of trauma. When I was 37, I added up all the hours I'd worked in my life and discovered that if I'd worked each of my jobs one after the other like a normal person, rather than several of them simultaneously, I would have done 45 years worth of work. No wonder I'm broken. My body assuming it's like 65 and requires retirement now is in fact no surprise. Other people cope in different ways. It's pretty common for survivors of the horrors to become alcoholics, to turn to drugs, or, yes, to die by suicide. Which is part of the point of this podcast. Yes, final girls are badass. Yes, we fought harder than most people can even conceive of. But we are tired. And if you've been through a final girl's level of horror and you're still alive, please take a moment to appreciate just how hard that has been and congratulate yourself on still being here. Most people won't ever understand how remarkable that is and how many final girls, like Sarah, ultimately don't survive. The Descent was directed by Neil Marshall and came out in 2005. The Descent Part 2 was directed by John Harris and came out in 2009. Our final girl, Sarah, was played iconically by Shauna McDonald. You can follow the podcast on Instagram at thatfinalgirllife or support us on patreon.com/thatfinalgirllife. The free tier gets you 2 episodes per month, the paid tier gets you 4. If you have any suggestions for future episodes, you can email them to thatfinalgirllife@gmail.com. Thank you for listening, and until next time, remember, the horrors persist, but so do we.